So was that the song that flipped the switch for you? Was that the thing that made you go, I want to be in music?
It probably was, but Del Shannon was there just a little bit before, like the same year, but maybe a few months earlier, when he had Runaway. As I walk along, I wonder what went wrong. And Runaway was like, oh, I thought it was the best thing I'd ever heard. It was just superb. And I found out from Del years later, when I got to finally meet him, that his managers, unbeknownst to him, had sped the record up. They'd very speeded it up and remastered it at that speed, which is quite a bit faster and a semitone higher. I think that's what made it sound so kind of otherworldly and kind of spacey.
So when you say you heard that sound and realised that's what I want to do, you weren't only listening to the lyrics and the music, but you were inspired by the sound.
Yeah. And it was always a feeling of, how do they do that?
Yes.
Who did that? Who thought of it?
Yeah.
Who actually told everybody what to play?
But tell me now that nowadays, if I was sat here going, how did they do that? I go onto YouTube and they show you anything. Everything's on the internet
now,
you need to know. But how did you, as a 12, 13-year-old, then become Jeff Lynne? I always think that you're like the Trevor Horn, because I always wanted to be produced by Trevor Horn.
Yeah.
Because I used to listen to Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Grace Jones, and I'd sit there with my earphones on going, how has this guy done it?
Mm-hmm.
And so, because you were the pioneer, you were the guy in the 70s who was like doing things that no one else could do. You took it to the next level. But how do you, from 12, 13 years old, become that guy?
I think one of the reasons is because I've got into a professional group called the Knight Riders in Birmingham.
So before ELO?
Much before, yeah. When I was 18, I joined that group, and they were a great group. We played every night.
Yeah.
Then I started to write songs.
Yeah.
On the B&O in 68. I joined in 66, and in 68 I finally got the tape recorder, started to do all these little tunes, and that's how I was from that B&O that I discovered what actually happened when you record sound and where you put the microphone.
So it was a self-discovery. There was no one else there saying, oh, try this. Right, okay.
No, never, because I had the front room to myself at my mum and dad's house in Birmingham, and I filled it all full of junk. I even had a Mellotron. I could afford a Mellotron at one point, which was great for the time.
This was all with your money from your gigs.
Yeah, just from the gigs.
You're broke because you're buying gear every time you gig.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think it's fascinating, that journey, because it's like the bit where you learn so much. You're like a sponge. You take it all in. Just give us an insight at the point where you've started ELO and it felt like, oh, wow, I've got a career here. What was the point when you realised this is hopefully going to be it forever now? I can do this job forever.
Well, that was when I think we had the first single out, which was called 10538 Overture.
Yep.
That was 1972.
Okay. I was one.
Happy birthday. And, it was like, it sounded pretty powerful to me at the time. I thought, now I think this might be onto something here.
Yeah.
And Roy Wood left just before that came out. Yeah. And it got into the top 10. Yeah. I was like, yeah, because I'd been desperate to get a hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a hit song, that would be something so special. That was the first one, okay. And it didn't guarantee you, like, success over a long period of time. I mean, you could come and go in them days.
Yeah.
But I started writing some other good ones, like Showdown. She cried to the southern wind, about a love that would shoot your hand. Every dream in the heart was gone, heading for a showdown. And they all became in the top 10. So I thought, there is a chance here.
Yes.
And then we started going to America, which was really different. I mean, to see how it all happened in America, that was sort of such an eye-opener.
And were you having success here at that point? Is that why you came
here?
Yeah,
got a top 40 hit with Roll Over Beethoven.
Fantastic, yeah.
And we started doing tours here. Did a lot of tours here, like 10 or 12 tours.
Wow.
And so we were quite well-known here. In fact, better known here than in England.
Oh, really?
For a while, yeah, because we were always over here.
Yes.
It started to trickle back from here into England again.
Yeah.
And started having more hits in England. Mm-hmm. And I think the big turning point was when I did an album called New World Record, which had about 3 hits on it, and they were all top 10 hits, which was great, you know, I was thrilled.
So you, I'm just trying to put, be a spectator of you back in those times, like pretty much like a 20-year block from 1970 to early 90s, you just were never out of studios. Even while you were on tour, if you were recording in Germany and, you know, you just studio, studio, studio.
That's all I wanted, really.
Right.
So the tours were always like a bit of a... Ooh. Get out of it. You know, I want to go in the studio and make something new. I always wanted to do something
new.
But
when did the... Because I remember when we were doing our shows in the 90s, there was only a small selection of other artists who, when they did live shows, they put on a spectacle, an ELO with the spaceship. And when did that start? When did you start thinking, this is more than just a gig, let's give people a show?
I know when that happened.
Yeah.
I made Out of the Blue in 1977.
Yeah.
And it was that cover picture.
Which I can still remember because we had it on vinyl in our house.
That's it.
Yeah.
Great. Well done. Anyway, that Out of the Blue was the thing that inspired building the spaceship as the stage. So it was a big fiberglass thing built in a shipyard somewhere.
Yeah.
And so that was the time we did like the biggest tour we'd ever done in 1978.
And did you take that spaceship everywhere?
Yeah, and most places, except there was a bit of a catch to it. It was so big. It took so long to get it put away and get it to the next gig by road that we just have to do 2 different shows, one without it, which was always a bit of
so
a...
So you were like piggybacking the spaceship. The spaceship
to
gonna
the
miss
one after.
Sunderland because he's going to Edinburgh.
Yeah, that's it. But it would be in America, so he's going from New York to Chicago.
Miles away.
And we got to be there tomorrow to play.
Right.
And of course you'd get there and there was no spaceship and they'd be a bit miffed, you know. Like, let's kill it.
That's brilliant.
Over Beethoven, gotta hear it again today.
that, you kept that going though, that theme, didn't you? It was always a big stage show. I remember watching the DVDs, the brilliant stage shows.
Thanks.
Do you look back now and just be proud, or do you wish you were back in that era where...
No, I would hate to be back in that era, really. I don't have many fond memories of that era at all. Because I didn't like the way we sounded, because I didn't have enough people in the group. I still have Richard Tandy, my piano player from then. Well, ELO's piano player from then. And we're still great pals, and he's my big pal for 45 years, and we still play together. But all the rest of it, I could completely do without. I loved selling all them records, you know, all those albums and everything. I've got, like, ridiculous amounts of gold and platinum albums, and they're all marvellous, you know. I love having them, but I wouldn't want to have to get them again, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying my time now much better, because with the new ELO and the new enthusiasm that I've got for it, it's much better.
Here's a question, and it's quite a serious one, and I go back to Trevor Horn when I say this. Like I say, I've dreamed of being produced by him for years, and we did a song called Shame with me, Robbie, and Trevor produced it. And he said something very poignant. He sent me a mix, and it was great. He said, "Did you hear the mix?" I was like, "Yeah, Trevor, it's brilliant." And I said to him, "Are you happy?" And he said, "Oh, don't ask me that, because I'm never happy." And when you just talked about that then, I mean, is it the perfection? Is that the reason you want to play all the instruments, produce, arrange? Are you just never happy? Even when you've finished something and you put it out there, do you listen 3 months later and go, "Oh, I wish I could change that"? Are you annoyed by not hearing perfection?
Occasionally. There's not that many that I hate, believe it or not. There's quite a handful of songs that I try not to listen to.
Right.
And hope I don't have to hear them.
Right.
But I won't mention what they are.
No, we don't.
In case somebody likes them.
Yeah, no. I think there's millions that like them, so let's not mention them.
There's just a few.
Yeah.
Other ones, I go, "Wow, I must have had me right head on for that one."
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And sometimes the perfectionist wins, and sometimes the other one that wins, you know, that's not quite got it.
Yeah.
But I think mainly I've more or less expressed myself the way I've always wanted to, usually.
It's just fascinating for me because, you know, you're so laid back, but clearly behind it all, you're such a perfectionist. And it's not for anyone else, it's for you.
Yeah.
It's for you, and that's
what's
unique.
It's got to sound right to me. That's all that matters, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, right, I'm going to finish this off very quickly. A couple of just quick-fire questions. When you're sitting and writing, because I know you still write and you're writing original things, do you know it's going to change millions of people's lives? Because your music has. I mean, I know it's something that we don't want to say we have, but your music has, definitely, on a worldwide scale. Do you consider that, or do you not consider it because it's off-putting?
I try not to think about that, because people do tell me that quite a lot, you know, in various, whether it's in person or I read about it, and it's really sweet that if it changed somebody's life for the better, and it does, it cheers some people up and it makes them feel much happier and then go through the day feeling better having listened to that song, and that's a wonderful thing.
But it doesn't put you off while you're writing, it's not something you consider?
No, I try not to think about anything but how can I get the best tune out of this with these chords. As long as my chords are good, I'm confident that I can get a nice tune.
I see. So the chords, the fact, because you keep coming back to that, the chords and them fitting together and feeling like you've got verse to bridge and then the swellings of chord, that's going to make you write a better melody and ultimately then a better lyric.